I'm David Loyne, reporting for the BBC World Service on how a recently found document is exposing war crimes and prompting calls for justice in Afghanistan. A Friday in Kabul, September 2013. Thousands of men gather by a hastily built stage on open ground next to the football stadium. They're mourning those on a list that's emerged of around 5,000 people killed by the state after a revolution in 1978, the year before the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, and the beginning of more than three decades of violence that's not yet ended.
Fakhir Kalakoni, unemployed Maoist. Abdul Kabir, teacher Maoist.
The list has the name of each man killed, their occupation, and alleged crime.
Mohammad Zahir, student Maoist.
The man reading finds himself on the list of those executed. He survived by a bureaucratic oversight. On paper, he should be dead.
Habib Rahman, employee sugar factory, Ikhwani. My God.
He is Habib Rahman. He worked at a sugar factory. When he was arrested, he was said to be an Ikhwani or religious militant. He denies this.
This list will get me back 35 years, and I do remember all those days. All those terrible days in the jail. During the jail, every prisoner was leaving for tomorrow, because every midnight they would come and bring a list, call the names and kill them. So from midnight, if my name was on the list, or somebody else's name was not in the list, we had a chance to live another 24 hours.
There's something very important and deeply humanizing about seeing the names. We begin to see them in terms of their individuality, their families, the people who've probably been wanting to mourn them for such a long time.
Patty Gossman, an expert on Afghanistan from Human Rights Watch, says justice has been a long time coming.
It's been very hard to get hold of actually any kind of paper trail, which is why this list being published was so important. One of the efforts by Afghan human rights groups here has been trying to increase the documentation, trying to find these records, because ultimately when there's an opportunity to pursue justice, this is the kind of information that's going to be invaluable in making the cases against the perpetrators.
Bir Muhammad, bus driver. Ogo Muhammad, postman.
Ali Hassan, butcher. Student. Khalik Khan, land owner.
Jamil
Muhammad Qasim,
grape merchant.
Pipers.
Malang Shah, land owner. Teacher.
Please remain seated, put your seatbelt fast. Muhammad
Omar, Khan, retired judge.
Retired.
The list of names of the dead that had such an impact more than three decades later emerged not in Afghanistan, but in Europe. To find out why, I'm on my way to Rotterdam to the office of the state prosecutor.
Employee with public
Muhammad Azim, student of literature.
Judge. Watchmaker, Hajendra Muhammad,
good enough. So we walked into a room, and immediately in front of us is the Afghan document written in Dari of the names of the people on the list. And I wonder how it got here. Thijs Bercher, the Dutch state prosecutor, has a file open on the desk about an Afghan known publicly only as Aminullah O.
He entered the Netherlands and requested for asylum. And during his asylum procedure, he gave a statement. And in that statement, he actually said, well, I was the chief of the interrogation department of the AXA, the security service of Afghanistan, in the late 70s. Statement is here. The question was whether any persons who fell under his responsibility were being maltreated during interrogation. And he said, well, of course. People were maltreated during the interrogations. And of course, I was responsible for that maltreatment, well, in fact, torturing. But that's how things go in Afghanistan. This information was passed on to us by the Immigration Service.
Commander Aminullah Osman, to give him his full name, thought his chances of asylum would be improved if he talked about his past as a torturer. It would mean he could not be returned to Afghanistan because his life would be in danger there. He did not imagine that he would end up facing investigation as a war criminal instead. Afghanistan, before the 1978 revolution, was another country, a staging post on the hippie trail, still poor but changing fast. It was reaching out to the world. Women were beginning to be educated and work, at least in the cities. One year, there was even a beauty contest. Zora Daoud was the first and only Miss Afghanistan.
But according to United Nations, in 1975, Kabul was one of the safest capital of the world.
Everything changed when a small group of relatively unknown radical Afghan communists backed by Moscow infiltrated the army, murdered the royal family and seized power in the spring of 1978. It was the Afghan month of Sour and it became known as the Sour Revolution.
Unfortunately, after Sour Revolution, the harmony of the society has been broken. And that's why I can tell that the Sour Revolution was the beginning of the misery for the people of Afghanistan.
Tanks loyal to young communist army officers now guard the palace where President Daoud, the last of the Afghan royal family, ruled. Inside, he and his family, including his young grandchildren, were shot dead when his palace guard lost their courageous battle to defend him.
The new regime was notoriously brutal. Torture, disappearance and murder were immediately adopted as tools of repression. Engineer Habib Rahman, number 3423 on the Sour death list, who somehow lived to tell the tale, fled to Australia and has now returned to try to rebuild Afghanistan. He wears Western clothes and looks like what he is, a smart businessman. He relives the moments of horror in Kabul 34 years ago, when he nearly didn't survive.
Why did it become so cruel so quickly in 1978, 1979, and after the Sour Revolution?
There was a good reason behind it. They started to deliver speeches against the religion of the people, the culture of the people, and the normal people of Afghanistan didn't accept them. And they had no education, no experience in the government. And they thought, we can control the people by force, and they couldn't do it.
And they tried to put a lot of people in prison, you know, the people that they were intellectual, they were engineers, they were doctors or writers or people they were like pro-West, they put them in jail.
With Engineer Habib, we've come to the house where you lived in the 1970s and this is where you were arrested.
Yes. I was asleep. They smashed the door and entered the house. About 20 people, officers and normal soldiers. They told the soldiers, if you move, just shoot them. They told me, okay, you have to go with us. When we walked out of the door, there was about 20 military cars and even a tank, armored tank. Then I thought, oh, something is going wrong. They took me to the investigation department of the secret police.
In the same time, we were conducting investigations in another case in Afghanistan. So the police was on the ground in Kabul.
34 years after Habib was taken off into the night to be tortured, the Dutch police begin to build their case against Aminullah O, one of his torturers. They're assisted now by the discovery in Kabul of secret police papers from the time, transfer orders listing the movement of detainees, collected and published in a book by an activist called Merwais Wardak.
So the police already had this book. And then our office phoned in and said, well, we just received this statement from the Immigration Service being very explicit by this Mr. Aminullah O, the chief of the interrogation department of the AXA. And they looked into the book and found him as a signatory of the transfer orders. So they went over to Merwais Wardak and he had the original transfer orders handed over to the police. And we started investigations from there. In our cases, this is really rare information, really valuable information. Original documents from conflict areas are quite rare, so we were really enthusiastic about that.
So you've got documents with his signature on, effectively sending people to executions or at least to torture. You've got him admitting torture, so you're wanting to carry out a criminal case against him. So then you said you were going to prosecute him in the Netherlands for war crimes.
Exactly. well, we had the obligation to start investigations and to prosecute, especially because there was a link with the Netherlands, with him residing in the Netherlands. So he fell within my jurisdiction.
He started questioning me and beating, putting electricity to the nails. And
they tied contact electrodes to your ears.
Yes, your fingers and all those.
And your fingers.
Yeah.
And then they drove a charge through it. Even on that first night, they arrested you.
Oh, no, straight away. Started beating and all those things for 8 days and nights.
What were they asking you? What did they think you'd done?
They were pushing me. Give us the name of your friends, the name of your friends.
Now, when you come back to this house, what's in your mind about that night? Because that was the last night you spent here.
Yeah, a nightmare.
Did he know that you were investigating him? Or did he know that his asylum case had been turned down?
He knew his asylum case was turned down, but he didn't know that we were investigating him.
So how did you stop him from leaving the country? Presumably he had some sort of travel document.
I don't feel free to go in details, but we had...
You were keeping an eye on him.
Thank you, we did, yeah. That's exactly what we did.
So you were keeping him under some sort of surveillance. He's still living in the Netherlands. His family have got permission to stay. He's been turned down, but he can't go anywhere else. And all the time you were putting together a criminal case.
Exactly. And on the basis of the transfer orders, we found witnesses.
They called 12 of us, our friends. They put us in a van. Windows were painted so you couldn't see outside. They took us to police station.
And that was where you lived for more than a year?
More than a year. And when we got to the gate of the prison, there is a blocks, block one, block two, block three, block four. They took us to block number four.
And one of those witnesses, that was quite extraordinary, said, well, I knew Amanullah on beforehand. And that's why I recognized him whilst being tortured. So I had this really strong evidence. From that, one of those witnesses who lived in Germany said that she knew a woman living in Hamburg who had documents. So the police went over to Hamburg and talked to her, and she had copies of the death lists. We knew from reports and also from witness statements that there had been these death lists who had been posted on the wall of the Ministry of Interior. So we were aware of the existence, but now we had the copies of these death lists.
Muhammad Aziz Farmer,
Muhammad Habibullah Baker, student. Muhammad Omar, Muhammad Judge,
veterinary student. Now, people were being taken out of the jail every night, and you didn't know who it was going to be, and they were shot. And they were shot here on this ground just outside the jail.
Well, this was the polygon area. From that white small building, starts from there, going all the way to the end.
This is very near the jail. We can see the windows of the cells from where we are.
Yeah.
So you could hear the shooting.
Yes. I think they were doing that by purpose. He was the target. Tomorrow could be me.
The 5,000 people on the list executed and buried on the patch of ground known as the Polygon outside Policzaki Jail was just a small fraction of those murdered by the state in 1978 and 1979. Reforms that were radical in the Afghan context, including rights for women and education for girls, threatened deeply felt conservative values, and the countryside rose up against an attempt to redistribute land. In an effort to keep control, the new regime murdered tens of thousands of people. That's when Afghanistan's nightmare began. Patty Gossman is from Human Rights Watch.
There was nothing quite like it in the years that followed. Their approach was not to put these people on trial as traitors or anything, but just to get rid of them. There were mass disappearances, thousands upon thousands of people disappearing, buried. Still now we don't know in what kind of mass graves.
Because of the horror that followed the Soviet invasion in 1979, when hundreds of thousands were killed and millions displaced, the killings in those years before have often been overlooked. No one's been brought to justice for them. Solomon Lajek, a former minister in that government, was so loyal that he wrote the communist national anthem.
I tracked down Solomon Lajek to the centre of Kabul, where, appropriately enough, he lives in a communist-era block of concrete flats. The Russians, when they were here, built these blocks across the centre of Kabul, and he lives comfortably enough still in the way that he did back in the 1970s. Yeah. Assalamu alaikum. Good evening. How are you? Very well indeed. Thank you for seeing us. How did the government, the communist government that came in 1978, how did it become so bloodthirsty? Why were so many people killed so quickly?
It is an interesting question. Tell me, is there a place where the war for power is without bloodshed, even in the West? I'm not saying that those killings were justified, because there was no forces capable of challenging us militarily. But those who were involved in the coup wanted power. They neglected the authority of the party and relied on the armed forces. The person responsible is very clear. I'm surprised that his name isn't mentioned in the West. His name is Hafizullah Amin.
How soon did the killing start after the Saur Revolution? How soon were people being taken and murdered?
From the beginning.
Why did you not leave that government then, if they were so bad at that time? Why did you not protest, you and your friends?
When a dictator comes, and when you make a critic, so you also go to the polygon. There is no other way. Are you going with us or no? If you are, don't go with us, so you are our enemy.
So you're responsible for those crimes too, for those innocent people who were killed?
We were not aware of those killings. Those killings were carried out by a secret group. The party was not aware of it. I object, because the West has not once pointed to Hafizullah Amin.
But he didn't do it on his own, and you were one of his ministers.
Ask the people of Afghanistan. I was his minister. Amin was a dictator. He was like Hitler. Do you know Hitler? Didn't Hitler have a party?
Solomon Lyak's defense is exactly that used by Hitler's ministers, that he was only obeying orders. More than three decades after Amin's reign of terror, the case in the Netherlands to prosecute Aminullah O for war crimes is building.
A number of the persons mentioned on the death list were also mentioned in the transfer orders. So the content was corroborated to a certain extent by the transfer orders that we knew were authentic.
So the list was strong enough, although it didn't have the, because it was a copy, it didn't have the forensic information, it was strong enough to be introduced as evidence.
We were ready to use this material as evidence in court.
And what happened next?
We had a case file ready and we were about to arrest him. And just literally a few days before that, he died. He passed away, and so that was the end of our case, our criminal case.
Aminullah O never faced justice. Because he died, the case against him was never heard in court and is revealed for the first time in this programme.
There are reports from Afghanistan tonight that the country's president has been overthrown. The coup came after thousands of Soviet troops were said to have moved in over the last 2 days to help crush a rebellion against the regime of President Hafizullah Amin.
At the end of 1979, Soviet troops invaded Afghanistan in confused circumstances. It turned out that Amin's Soviet backers had lost patience with him and he was murdered. Habib listened through cell bars wrapped with plastic sheeting to keep out the cold as the sky filled with helicopters and the roads filled with tanks.
At about 9 o'clock, we could hear the noise of armored tanks, and minute by minute, it was getting closer to the jail. And everybody was thinking, hey, whether they will kill us, they will blow up the jail, there will be a fight, or what? The tanks and armored vehicles was getting closer and closer and closer to the jail. And about 15 past 10, there was a knife cut the plastic curtain. And we could see a blonde Russian soldier said, hello, or something like that.
It's a greeting. He was greeting you. He was consoling you that he wasn't going to cause you harm, I guess.
Exactly. The day they released us, there was 10,000 people getting out of the jail, and everybody was received by their families or loved ones. When I walked out of the jail, I couldn't see any member of my family. Then I went home. Then finally I find my brother. And I asked him why. I was very upset, very depressed. After a long time, I'm getting out of the jail, but nobody is there. My brother started crying and said, last day or day before, we went to see the list they hanged in the Ministry of Interior. telling the people that these people have been killed by the past regime, the Islamist regime, you know, show your name up there. You know, I thought it's a waste of time and it will be very hard for us to go there and not find you.
The death list was temporarily pinned to the walls of the Interior Ministry in 1979 to discredit the toppled Amin regime, and then it disappeared. It had an enormous reaction in 2013 when it was released onto the internet by the Dutch authorities, who'd uncovered it in pursuing the case against Aminullah O.
As we saw when the list was published last fall, it was a hugely emotional experience for people seeing the names of relatives that they had no news about for more than 30 years, and finally able to hold these mourning ceremonies for the first time. This happened in Europe, among the diaspora, as well as here in Afghanistan.
And as far as dealing with the crimes of the past is concerned, how good has Afghanistan been?
Not very good at all. The moment to have really looked at this was very soon after the transition in the end of 2001. That was the only opportune moment we have had, and it has been squandered because political expediency dictated that we had to work with precisely those people who were responsible for many of the most serious abuses of the last years. The approach was, needed these commanders on the ground as part of the fight against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. And as a result, there was absolutely no concern for the records of these warlords.
Far from looking into the record of the warlords, the Afghan government suppressed the results of the most exhaustive investigation into the crimes of the past, looking not only at the communist years, but later periods, the Mujahideen rebellion against the communists, the murderous civil war between rival Mujahideen, and of course, the Taliban years. Nadir Nadiri, who wrote that report, faced death threats and was dismissed from running the Afghan Human Rights Commission by President Karzai for daring to look into past war crimes. And the Western powers who defeated the Taliban did nothing to prevent the cover-up, although in 2001 they held all the levers of power.
You take the strongest armed man in this country up to 2005, they were feeling whatever members of international community, America, UK or others, want to do in Afghanistan and want to get rid of people, they're capable of doing it.
To find out why international forces did not hold the old warlords to account in 2001, I've come to Westminster to see the then British Foreign Secretary Jack Straw. He wrote at the time that warlords were a fact of life in Afghanistan.
In this kind of situation, you're always in an area of acute moral hazard, which is why I'm sure I made the point about the fact we had to deal with the warlords, because at the time it was better to deal with them than to have them contributing to the chaos rather than trying to reduce it. So those were the difficult choices, and it wasn't that we ignored the need for there to be a proper justice system, but you have to take one step at a time in these really difficult circumstances. We also had to work through the agency of the Afghans. But do I believe that there should be a justice process for these poor souls who were assassinated at the end of the 70s and subsequently, and their families? Yes, of course I do. And it is never too late to follow through that system.
The words of Western ministers ring hollow on the ground in Afghanistan. It is too late for justice, since the warlords, particularly the former Mujahideen from the 1980s and 90s, reclaimed so much of their power that only a few years after the fall of the Taliban, they'd won immunity from prosecution for past crimes. For Habib, outside the walls of Polichaki prison, in the dust of a secret burial ground he narrowly avoided, justice feels a long way off.
If a person killed 1,000 people, justice is not to take him to the prison and give them another life.
What would be the justice?
To go to the same place. I would say so.
And he's pointing to the ground where thousands are buried, thousands of people who were killed who were in Polichaki jail.
Most of those high-ranking officers are now in the power in Afghanistan or living like kings outside the country. They destroyed the life of thousands of families. Is the justice to give them the chance to live like a king, the next day come and run for presidency or power? No. they should pay for the crime that they carried.
Afghanistan's rampant corruption and the weakness of its democracy are intimately connected to its failure to deal with war crimes. The communists at the beginning of the long war and the Taliban at the end were both brutal. But the men entrenched in power now are conservative rural power brokers, warlords, many of whom have blood on their hands too. They've seen off all attempts to account for the crimes of the past and shelter in their newly won immunity from prosecution. And apart from a few isolated examples, such as the prosecutors in the Netherlands painstakingly building cases like this one with elusive documents, the world has preferred to look the other way. Thijs Berger.
It's all a matter of trying to end impunity. I mean, we're talking about over 30 years of war crimes being committed by all sides, and nothing is really being done about it. There's no international court taking these crimes into account. It's outside of the jurisdiction of the ICC, at least time frame of these cases. So it's just absolute impunity in Afghanistan. And if there's anybody residing in the Netherlands who was involved in those crimes, we have to act upon it. And that's what we did.
Without asking for details, are there Afghans or people who are in Afghanistan who are in the Netherlands at the moment who you're investigating for war crimes from this period?
Yes, there are.
You've been listening to the documentary on the BBC World Service produced by Neil McCarthy, with additional Afghan production by Mahfouz Zubaydi.